On this week's 51%, we'll spend some time with a philosophy professor and discuss misogyny.
I think that misogyny is very much a reaction to social progress.
Plus, you'll hear the Massachusetts twist on women's suffrage. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Is an example of misogyny. Kate Mann is an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University, where she has been teaching since 2013. Prior, she was a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows. She did her graduate work in philosophy at MIT. Her focus is on moral philosophy, feminist philosophy, and social philosophy. Mann's book, Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny, talks about the nature, function, and persistence of misogyny. I asked her to define the term.
So I think of misogyny as the system that polices and enforces gender expectations for women, and so results in hostility, particularly when they're violating those expectations or when they're merely perceived to be violating those expectations.
And conversely, I think there's perhaps a misinterpretation of the term as being women haters.
Yeah, right. I think that's much too narrow a definition. So something that I've written about and that I try to argue against in my book is what I call the naive conception of misogyny, where misogyny is billed as this deep psychological property of individual agents, primarily, who are the people, the men, paradigmatically, who hate women. And while I do think that misogyny involves a lot of hostility and hateful treatment, I'm interested in defining misogyny from the perspective of the victims or targets of misogyny. So that's the kind of conceptual shift that I try to effect and that gives the different definition I propose, where misogyny is more a matter of policing and enforcing gender norms and expectations.
To police this, one has to recognize that it exists, right, before one can actually do anything about it. So are we anywhere near this stage in our society today?
Yeah, I think that raising awareness of misogyny is sort of a first step towards rectifying it. So without recognizing some of those policing and enforcement mechanisms, it becomes very difficult, as you point out, to change it. And so I think we still have a long way to go, but I think that there are hopeful signs that people are beginning to call out the misogyny that's directed at women in ways that range from institutional policies like the anti-abortion movement we've seen becoming particularly virulent this year, right to more individual targeting of women like the ways in which prominent female public figures are often targeted with misogynistic invective.
Now, in talking about your book, you're obviously referring to Down Girl. So what led you to write Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny?
Yeah, so I actually became interested in the topic, the nature of misogyny, after my first year of teaching at Cornell. And I think one of the things that was particularly striking to me was just the vulnerability of the young women that I was teaching became particularly salient to me when I did occupy that new role as a professor. Just being aware of the alarming statistics about rape culture and sexual harassment in the academy just made me very interested to think about what I could do to try to understand the problem better and hopefully play some role in helping to improve things. So after, almost exactly after I'd finished that year of teaching, the Isla Vista shootings happened, where Elliot Roger, a 22-year-old man, targeted the women at the Alpha Phi sorority house at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And what really caught my attention, as well as the horrifying details about that case, was the way that people tended to deny that it was misogyny. despite the fact that he had posted rants about wanting to wreak revenge against the quote-unquote hot blonde sluts who'd refused or rejected him. And so, yeah, the sense that there was this very common social denialism about the misogyny that young women were facing was what kind of provoked me to want to write about the subject, and eventually that became the book that I published in 2017.
It does seem to me that misogyny is amplified as a topic on college campuses in recent years. I mean, we're starting to take women at their word and not assuming they brought on the action or behavior, and maybe this can pan out to a larger stage of, do women bring this on? Is this a view that is replicated, incorrectly so in many cases, that they bring it on? They should do something about it, not the reverse, where men or those perpetrating misogyny bring it on. I mean, where do we come out on this? How do we start, as you say, policing and enforcing?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of moral confusion that, as a moral philosopher, I was interested in trying to combat about who is responsible for, in particular, whose pain. So Elliot Rodger kind of became a poster boy for incels, who, for those listeners who haven't heard that term before, it's short for involuntary celibate, and has over time come to be a label for the kind of aggrieved, entitled young man who feels that he's being denied sex and also often love relationships with women. And there's a sense in which even the public responses to the rise of incels is often too, what I call, sympathetic. So too sympathetic to him, and not cognizant enough of the fact that, look, loneliness is a common problem, and it's, you know, certainly something that we'd hope can be ameliorated. But it's not anyone's responsibility to provide anyone else with company and love and sex and affection. And for most people, they are able to accept that there will be lonely periods in their life, or periods where they'd like a relationship and don't have one. That nonetheless isn't something to be angry at specific people about. It's something that is a regrettable state of affairs, or just a bummer or a downer. But these entitled young men, they really both feel that they're owed something, and to some extent there are social reactions that back that up and say that women are the ones who are to blame for not providing them with that company.
Or for taunting. Right? For dressing a certain way, or saying
right.
certain things, or whatnot.
No, there's enormous amounts of victim blaming and policing women's dress, their choices. There's much more energy that's often invested in, you know, supposedly helpfully teaching women to avoid scenarios where they're likely to be raped versus teaching men not to rape. And, I mean, the former is both offensive in that it, you know, it implies women have a responsibility to police themselves as to where they go and what they wear, and it's also monumentally ineffective. So there's no evidence that, you know, dressing in a baggy sweatshirt or whatever it is will prevent rape. That's not an effective rape prevention strategy.
Thank you for saying that. You've mentioned it a few times, entitled, and that is the name of your next book. And I was hoping you could talk about what that will be, although I can hazard a guess. but maybe you can say what's leading you to write this book.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. So the first book I wrote was somewhat more academic, and so I'm looking to tackle these kinds of themes of male entitlement, especially white male entitlement, in connection with misogyny, exploring how it entitlement gives rise to misogyny in a way that's a bit more accessible to a wider audience. And the other theme of the book, and the reason I chose the title entitled, is that I think there are also lots of things that women should in general feel more entitled to and be granted more social permission to have and to do.
For example?
Like having, for example, having care that is devoted to them rather than that they're doling out. So we have lots of evidence that, say, within households where it's male-female, and especially after, if that couple has children, afterwards there is an enormous amount of evidence that has been really well canvassed in a recent book called All the Rage by Darcy Lockman. There's evidence that male entitlement means that she will be devoting an enormous amount of care to the children and the household and also to him, and his contributions will be comparatively minimal, even if they're working comparable hours. And in fact, the only situation in which male-female contributions to a household and childcare begin to approach parity is where he's unemployed and she works full-time. And that's begin to approach parity. So thinking about ways in which women are more entitled to leisure and to equal partnerships, and there's also a chapter about the ways in which women's pain tends to be in the medical system minimized and disregarded, especially for Black women, for Black and brown women, I should say. Thinking about ways in which more women are more entitled to have their pain be taken seriously, as well as having their testimony taken seriously, that's a big part of the book as well.
I also wanted to know your thoughts on misogyny in this society as opposed to outside the U.S. I mean, I know the Omega Conference will home in on cross currents. We're at a time where there's so much banding together of women and excelling and addressing the issues of today, and yet there's such regression in the society, as you mentioned earlier even, that we're seeing with racism, family separation, shootings. I mean, the list continues, right? So cross currents is a perfect term for this.
Well, my research is very much focused on the United States, and I also think about my home country of Australia and the UK cultures, where I feel like I'm comparatively speaking an insider, because my methodology, so it's partly a methodological choice, because I think of myself as doing cultural analysis, which really requires that insider perspective often. But the other part of it is that I think there's a way of talking about misogyny that for people in, you know, especially a white liberal milieu in the United States, for example, is relatively easy, which is to view it as a property of othered cultures. And that can easily shade into a kind of racist sense that, firstly, it's not our problem, and second, it's a problem that's perpetrated by Black and brown men. And I just don't think that's true. I think that misogyny is very much a reaction to social progress. So I would be the last person to deny that lots of feminist, egalitarian social progress has been made in the U.S. and Australia and so on. But I think because of that, there's a tremendous amount of hostility and backlash. And I think that's really important to recognize.
It is, but is it also necessary to continue the progress?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I hope not, because the backlash is so ugly and sometimes violent, as we've been seeing, you know, for example, with the Dayton shooter. But it is, I would say, very unsurprising historically that we're at a moment where women have made rapid social progress, at least in certain sectors, and that leaves enormous numbers of more vulnerable women in still more vulnerable positions. So often, sadly, it's not the women who are the beneficiaries or the primary beneficiaries of the progress who have the worst of misogyny. It's precisely those who are the most vulnerable socially, whether due to race, class, sexuality, being trans, those forms of, or being disabled, those forms of marginalization mean that often we're seeing the most privileged women benefit from progress and more vulnerable women really bearing the brunt of the kind of backlash that misogyny often involves.
What in your mind is one of the more subtle forms of misogyny that really needs attention if we're going to continue to make progress or make significant progress?
Yeah, that's a great question. So recently I've been writing about mansplaining and its connection with gaslighting, where mansplaining is the superficially more benign version of a sense of epistemic entitlement, which I think of as someone, typically a man, thinking that he's entitled to be positioned in the conversation as the knower or the authority or the possessor of information, who disseminates that information, pun intended, and who issues authoritative explanations. And although, you know, it can be no more than merely annoying to have someone, you know, for example, mansplain moral philosophy to me, say, I feel like this always happens to me on an airplane where, you know, there's this sense that he's entitled to hold forth about this subject matter that's my, you know, bread and butter and livelihood and training. But I think it is both pernicious and it's a symptom of a deeper sense that he's the one who's entitled to hold forth. He's the one who's entitled to an opinion. And that can have an effect that is very silencing of and erasing of women.
Absolutely. I am a big fan of the pun, and that one was spectacular. So,
thank you.
I very much appreciate it.
Apologies to your listeners who aren't pun fans, but I couldn't resist.
What do you hope to get from Omega and bring to Omega, given all the great minds that will be there, yet coming from very different places, but a common goal?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm so excited. I have to say I'm a particularly huge fan of both Tarana Burke and Roxane Gay, and so getting to hear them speak is just an enormous privilege. I'm looking forward to all of the speakers, but I had a particular fangirl moment when I realized they were on the program. In terms of what I will be speaking about myself, I think what I want to do is to offer my definition of misogyny, and in the hopes that that is at least a fruitful basis for discussion and potentially disagreement. Because, you know, some people may think the older, what I call the naive definition is better to stick with that. So I think it's a nice springboard for a discussion. And I also want to make some suggestions about, according to my definition of misogyny, when that predicts one will often encounter hostility as a woman in ways that I think can be valuable in letting you just keep going. So in some ways, you know, forewarned, it's forearmed. And if you know the particular loci of misogynist aggression that you're likely to be in for, if you, say, clash with a well-liked, privileged man, for example, whose views you think are incorrect, knowing to expect a certain amount of hostility or backlash, I think is both helpfully predictive of what you can lean into, as it were, yourself, because the aim isn't to avoid this kind of conflict, but rather to keep doing what you want to be doing anyway. And also to see when other people might be in for misogynist backlash so you can support other women who are going through this. So when, say, you have someone who is in a particularly vulnerable position, you can practice solidarity.
Always a good idea to advance a worthwhile cause. You know, I was thinking all these thoughts are provoking a lot of thought here. And, you know, I'm thinking that we've played the victim even when we don't think so, simply in just accepting. And by accepting, I don't mean that agreeing with, but just tolerating is the better verb. Tolerating, you run into a misogynist and you tolerate that viewpoint because you know you're going to walk away from it and disregard. I mean, because I guess we as women, and I say this so incredibly generically, are used to tolerating that? Is it a case of turning the tide in those small ways of running into that person on the plane and instead of tolerating the statements and all of that, turning it back around and doing something about it on, you know, whatever scale is necessary and appropriate? Is it that we have to start flipping it back and not just internalizing it?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I think that can be inner forms of resistance as well as outer forms of resistance. I mean, the truth is, you know, often I don't have the energy to deal with a mansplainer and I'll just let him go on, but I'm not listening. So the inner resistance is tuning out. And also, I think just as importantly, in those situations where you make the calculation, look, I don't really want to be reaching this person. He's shown himself to be entitled and misguided, and it's not my job to, you know, remonstrate with him when I have limited time, energy, and I'm trapped, you know, particularly if you're trapped on a plane with someone in the seat next to you, it's, you know, awkward and unpleasant to do this. Nonetheless, not feeling guilty about putting on your headphones, it's like a small act of resistance that I didn't have the wherewithal to do that before I read a lot of feminist philosophers and more popular feminist authors who really articulated for me, well, who's entitled to what and how and why. So I think it's very much a case-by-case basis. You know, don't clip your wings and refrain from doing things that are super important to you. Like for me, writing my books that will inevitably garner some hostility if my theories are right, because they're, you know, acts of being outspoken as a feminist. You know, doing that stuff that's really important and kind of saving my energy when it's not so important, or when I don't stand to really benefit from that act of resistance. Yeah, I think just being aware of what you're dealing with and when and how it matters, I think that goes a long way towards helping women make more informed choices about when to engage and when not to bother.
That was Kate Mann, author of Down Girl, The Logic of Misogyny. She is associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University and is working on her next book, entitled. She is speaking at the Omega Women's Leadership Center's Women and Power Gathering Our Strength Conference. The conference is September 27th through 29th at Omega in Rhinebeck, New York. Women have had the right to vote in the U.S. for a century after a long and difficult battle that spanned generations. Barbara Berenson is the author of Massachusetts and the Woman Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers. The core of the book is an argument that Bay State suffragists have been given short shrift by history and that their efforts were on the bleeding edge of a national struggle. Berenson spoke to 51%'s Josh Landis about her book and the overlap between suffragists and abolitionists.
My book really discusses the battle for the vote that began in Massachusetts during the anti-slavery movement in the 1830s, and I pretty much conclude, although of course the story is not over, with the ratification of the 19th Amendment in 1920.
So what was the overlap between abolitionists and people pushing for the women's vote?
So the overlap is huge because the women's rights movement grew directly out of the abolitionist or anti-slavery movement. What happened was when the nation's abolitionist movement began in the 1830s, and Boston was the leading center of that movement, there were a number of women who were very sympathetic to the anti-slavery movement and very much wanted to join. And they began speaking out against slavery. And they were told that they had no right to do so because women were supposed to remain in the domestic sphere, the sphere of home, taking care of husband, children, family, and so forth. And women pushed back, and they claimed that they had a right to speak out and care about public issues. And that really is the genesis of the women's rights movement. Over time, over the next 10 to 20 years, the focus became the vote. But the whole movement began directly from the anti-slavery movement.
So you just touched on this, but what was that community like in Massachusetts at the time? The people pushing for what at the time were very radical cultural shifts in how political equity was distributed.
Yes. Well, the abolitionist movement was a radical movement to begin with, because even though the North had, of course, ended slavery many years earlier, the North benefited tremendously economically from slavery. All those famous textile factors that we talk about and so forth, of course, were making fortunes for wealthy people in Massachusetts and providing jobs for many others by turning, for example, slave-grown cotton into cloth. So the abolitionists were radical to begin with, and then the abolitionists that welcomed women to join them in the movement, people like William Lloyd Garrison, were radical in the extreme. And a number of women, though, were drawn to that movement, began speaking out against slavery, began writing against slavery, began holding conventions of anti-slavery women. And it's those activities that led to a formal women's rights movement.
So, of course, the vote was ultimately achieved. Women received the right to vote. What did that momentum go into next after that monumental achievement was accomplished?
In 1920? Well, it went into several things. First of all, of course, there were women who remained disenfranchised after 1920. Most importantly, African-American women in the South who no sooner achieved the right to vote than were stripped of the right to vote by the same Jim Crow laws that stripped African-American men in the South of the right to vote. So immediately there was concern about that, although that didn't really take off and become a major issue for many people, particularly in the North, until the 1960s. But the lack of voting rights for African-Americans was an issue, obviously, from 1920 onward. In addition, energy of women became poured into issue of how to improve women's lives. And so the Equal Rights Amendment, for example, was first introduced in the 1920s. So there was concern about, now that women finally had access to the ballot box, what would their priorities be and how would they use it?
That was Barbara Berenson, author of Massachusetts and the Woman Suffrage Movement, Revolutionary Reformers. She was speaking with 51%'s Josh Landes. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1574.